In the fourth chapter of Joyce's A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, the young man, Stephen Dedalus, is walking along the wooden bridge down the Bull Wall. He drew forth, Joyce reports, a phrase from his treasure and spoke it softly to himself, a day of dappled seaborne clouds. The phrase and the day and the scene harmonized in a chord. Words, was it their colors? He allowed them to glow and fade, hue after hue, sunrise gold, the russet and green of apple orchards, azure of waves, the grey-fringed fleece of clouds. No, it was not their colours. It was the poise and balance of the period itself. Did he then love the rhythmic rise and fall of words better than their associations of legend and colour? Or was it that, being as weak of sight as he was shy of mind, he drew less pleasure from the reflection of the glowing, sensible world through the prism of a language many-coloured and richly storied, than from the contemplation of an inner world of individual emotions mirrored perfectly in a lucid, supple, periodic prose? I've quoted that passage from The Portrait mainly to emphasise that to Joyce, as to Stephen, language always seemed to offer itself as a counter-truth to the truth of reality. Of course, among his many senses of language, Joyce had a journeyman sense too. He was quite willing to treat sentences as useful instruments to disclose a reality not itself linguistic. One of the stories in Dubliners begins, "Mrs. Mooney was a butcher's daughter. She was a woman who was quite able to keep things to herself, a determined woman." Those sentences are not as straightforward as they sound. They tell us not necessarily the truth about Mrs. Mooney, or what God or the world thinks of her, but what she thinks of herself. It is her accent we hear, the precise degree of assertiveness her voice would deliver. But the sentences are still predicated on the assumption that there is a world which language merely negotiates. Dappled seaborne clouds would persist even if the English language didn't. Granted, but Joyce was deeply susceptible to the opposite notion too, that words as such far surpass the character by which they usefully refer to things and help us to administer them. It was Samuel Beckett and not Joyce who wrote, "Words have been my only loves, not many." But Joyce might have written it from the sentiment that finds words purer and richer than anything they merely denote. Some of his styles acknowledge, like Mrs. Mooney, a world more or less given. Its reality can be manipulated, but not in the end transformed. But he has other styles which testify not to worlds and realities as given, but to another world, sustained only by the desire of it. If the world is, according to Wittgenstein, everything that is the case, then in reading Joyce we have to assume also a second world, everything that is not the case, but is so intensely desired that, so far as the imagination of desire is in question, it amounts to its own case. The two worlds are not indeed totally separate. They couldn't be. The first world, even in a life like Joyce's, of much grief, is likely to give forth a few consolations, appeasing some old wounds. The second world, so far as it takes a linguistic form, has to admit many echoes from the world it otherwise repudiates. But if there are writers who accept the given world, to the extent of annotating it and finding their satisfaction in doing little more, Joyce is not one of them. He is intransigent in desiring a world that never was, or that was only in the poetic fragments that would replace it. But I have to qualify this report, if only to take account of such a scene as the one in Ulysses, the second chapter, where Stephen helps the boy Cyril Sargent with his sums. "Ugly and futile, lean neck and tangled hair, and a stain of ink, a snail's bed. Yet someone had loved him, borne him in her arms and in her heart. But for her the race of the world would have trampled him underfoot, a squashed, boneless snail. Richard Blackmore, I recall, once quoted that passage and distinguished between Stephen Dedalus and Leopold Bloom largely on the strength of it, saying that the passage shows Stephen at his most tender. He transcends his intransigence and comes on the conditions of life, which is where Bloom is all the time. There again we have the two worlds, and only a different vocabulary for them. Leopold Bloom accepts the conditions of his life and wants only to succeed in forgetting their most painful embodiments, his father's suicide, his son's death, fears for his daughter, and at 4 o'clock, the certainty that Molly is taking Blazes Boylan to her bed. Still, Bloom remains in his conditions and makes the middling best of them. But Stephen resents every condition and would accept life only if it were another life, except for rare lapses into a more general acknowledgement. The question is, what form does desire take in this intransigent sense when it comes into language and disdains the chore of annotation? I want to come upon an answer to this a little roundabout. Several years ago, the critic Kenneth Burke proposed a certain pattern in the development of a writer. His notion is that most writers start off by writing of themselves and giving every privilege to their own feelings. The ideal form of this phase is the short lyric poem, or the lyrical fiction which is hardly fiction at all. Some writers never escape from this phase, but the major writer escapes at least far enough to acknowledge the existence of other people and to let them live their own lives. Better still if he can imagine other lives, and best of all if these lives are vigorously distinct from his own. If the chronology could be bent a little, we might take Joyce as a case in point, starting out with the early fragile poems, the first version of the portrait, then the portrait itself, and the luridly imagined episode that took the form of the play Exiles. Then the crucial development in his career would be the diversion of privileged interest from Stephen, the hero of lyrical experience, to Leopold Bloom, who sustains the middling perfection of putting up with things. But Dubliners breaks the symmetry of that development, a very early work, largely written in 1905 from jottings earlier still. So we have to say that there were at least early stirrings, even in the lyrical or self-expressive phase, of the recognitions that issued fully in Ulysses. But the pattern has further to go. It sometimes happens, even in a book which takes communication as its morality, that a writer, in the process of imagining lives other than his own, will come upon possibilities purely internal to his medium, possibilities which surpass the morality of communication. Some writers may glimpse those possibilities and decide to leave them alone, presumably because they find security in the bond of communication and would not want to be released from it. But there are other writers who, coming upon those possibilities, will insist on exploiting them as if to the end of the line. To those writers, if something is glimpsed as possible, it becomes an aesthetic necessity. It must be done. The particular possibility Joyce came upon in writing the later chapters of Ulysses was that of dissolving the barrier between one word and another, a procedure which might correspond to dissolving the distinction between the conscious and the unconscious phases of the mind. Language is not responsive to transitions, states of feeling which melt or merge in one another beyond rational discrimination. The reason is that words in conventional forms are separated from one another, and they tend to divide states of feeling into particles which don't correspond to the history of the feeling it denotes. Music was the most fascinating art to writers in the last years of the 19th century because it was good at transitions. Think of the natural history of feelings as we hear them in Wagner and Debussy. There are no fractures, no clear demarcation between one feeling and another. The deficiency of words is not the indeterminacy which is said to afflict them, but the abrupt demarcation between one word and the next, which corresponds to nothing in anyone's experience. Suppose you wanted to write a book, a kind of dream play, in which the conscious and unconscious phases of the mind would be blurred beyond rational redemption, in which the conventional distinctions on which we rely would be dissolved, distinctions between past and present, the dead and the living, one person and another, history and myth, animal and human. When Joyce walked through the British Museum and looked at the Assyrian and Egyptian monuments, he felt, as he told Arthur Power, that the Assyrians and Egyptians understood better than we do the mystery of animal life, a mystery which Christianity has almost ignored. Since the advent of Christianity, he said, we seem to have lost our sense of proportion, for too great stress is laid on man. Scholars have argued that it was the Egyptian Book of the Dead which most inspired Joyce to write a book in which such conventionally useful distinctions would be dissolved. The book tells of the journey of the dead to achieve eternal justification and resurrection in Amenti, the Elysian fields. The deceased assumed the power of the gods, and above all by identifying himself with Osiris, the type of death and resurrection. Osiris and his sister wife Isis each played many roles, their personalities constantly dissolving and forming again as in a dream of being. The material Joyce read in Sir E. A. Wallace Budge's Gods of the Egyptians, and several other similar books, gave him the motif of death and resurrection in a tradition far removed from the Christian one, and therefore free of the historical complication in a doctrine too familiar for his purposes. Finnegan's Wake is still a book in English, of a sort. Or rather, the structure of such divisions as it allows, whether we call them sentences or not, is recognizably English. But the words are confounded by taking to themselves diverse linguistic affiliations and echoes from a dozen languages. Some parts of it are more speakable than others, notably the famous section we can still hear in Joyce's recording of it, the scene in which washerwomen gossip as they do their chores on the banks of the Liffey. But by and large, the book remains a private place for scholars. Now, that situation may change. Ulysses was many years in the world before anyone but a professional student thought of reading it. Now it's widely read and not merely studied. The history of Radio Telefiche Aaron will document as a notable exploit the reading of the entire book, an act sure to gain entry to the Guinness Book of Records, not only for its length, but for its bravado. Finnegan's Wake, too, may have such a future, though many of its sequences seem to defeat the speaking voice. But I doubt if the Wake will ever be readable unless we extend our notion of language to accommodate its procedures. Instead of receiving words as tokens of reference and vehicles of a meaning separable from the words, we would have to think of words as what the Wake once calls them, words of silent power, for which the required authority is not the dictionary, but the history of magical practice. And if we want a motto from the Wake itself, there is one on page 570, a reference to Thoth, the god of speech, magic, and writing, secretary to the gods, and, as Mark Troy has pointed out, responsible for the writing of the Book of the Dead. So we read on page 570, "Well, but remind to think, your yesterday is Morgana's war, and that it is always tomorrow in Thoth's Tother's place. Amen." I've mentioned words of silent power for a more available reason. A well-known episode in The Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man has Stephen engaged in a little struggle of words with the English Dean of Studies in the university. A struggle on the respective provenance of the words funnel and tundish. Stephen wins the occasion for what it's worth, but then he starts thinking of the English language and of the Dean's possession of it. He felt, we read, with a smart of dejection, that the man to whom he was speaking was a countryman of Ben Jonson. He thought, the language in which we are speaking is his before it is mine. How different are the words home, Christ, ale, master, on his lips and on mine. I cannot speak or write these words without unrest of spirit. His language, so familiar and so foreign, will always be for me an acquired speech. I have not made or accepted its words. My voice holds them at bay. My soul frets in the shadow of his language. I've quoted that passage mainly to remark upon the edginess of Joyce's own relation to the English language. It's not precisely the edginess of those Irish writers in our own day who feel that they must retain contact in some way with the Irish language, either by writing in it, as several poets do, and as Michael Hartnett has given up writing in English to do, or by translating it, as Thomas Kinsella, Seamus Heaney, and other poets have done, into an English mindful of the language it has displaced. I can't hear in Joyce any such misgiving. I don't recognise any evidence that he ever wanted to write in Irish or to pay his tribute to a dispossessed language and its culture. But I think he needed, as Stephen did, the sentiment of being homeless, at odds with whatever offered itself to him as his condition. There are some artists who need restlessness as others need peace. As Oliver Goldsmith said of someone, he only frets to keep himself employed. Joyce didn't say, as Stephen did, my soul frets in the shadow of his language. But Joyce, too, cultivated a fretting, if not a fretful, relation to the English language. And I think because he needed the conditions which could only be met by an exertion of will and power. He needed to refuse the mother tongue, as Stephen needed to refuse his mother's deathbed request. Joyce's exercise of will and power is clear in several aspects of his career. He wrote in an English which he thought of as something to be mastered. He didn't think of his work in that language as a work of collaboration with the great writers in the English tradition, or with the values that tradition embodied. F.R. Leavis often maintained that William Blake's genius was most fully manifested in his sense of being an English poet, a poet, that is, engaged in a continuous creative collaboration with and within the English language. Now, there's nothing of such a sentiment in Joyce's relation to English. How could there be, given that he was an Irishman, whether he liked that fate or not? But he also exercised his power nearer home and homelessness. If he had been willing to subdue his pride, he could have aligned himself with the aims of the Irish literary revival, a movement, after all, hospitable to the extremely diverse purposes reflected in George Moore, Yeats, Douglas Hyde, Lady Gregory, and J.M. Singh. But he was never willing to subdue his pride for such a cause. Indeed, while his work is full of Yeatsian echoes and allusions, he took Yeats as his chief antagonist. There's a current theory of literary history, best recommended by the critic Harold Bloom, that a strong writer turns his strength to account by choosing a great precursor, a major writer different in the kind of his genius and incorrigible in its degree, by choosing him and engaging him in a struggle as if to the death. In that sense, Yeats is Joyce's chosen and fated precursor. Joyce had to swerve from Yeats's way of being a genius and disown its forms. So it was almost inevitable that Joyce would choose not any of the Irish ways of being a genius, but the European way. I've never felt much inclined to lose sleep over Joyce's exile, or the conditions which allegedly drove him from Ireland. The truth is that he wasn't driven, unless we mean that he was driven by a fretting and chafing sense of any conditions offered him. The collusion of chance and choice made Joyce the kind of artist he became. Chance, by making him an Irishman and keeping him in that condition. Choice, by which I mean his choosing to become an artist of European scope and grandeur, blood brother to Dante, Shakespeare, Swift, Flaubert, Pater, and Ibsen. A European, in that sense, is something you choose to become. You can't be born to it. You're not a European merely by being born in France or Germany. Yeats chose Plato and Plotinus for friends, but the choice was merely opportunistic, not a matter of principle. Joyce's choice of Europe was indeed a matter of principle. I think he wanted to live in such a spirit as to make home whatever he chose to remember, and thereafter to have a chiefly nomadic relation to life. This suggests that he wanted the unsettled conditions from which the artistic detachment which we associate with Flaubert would emerge. But I'm inclined to emphasize rather the example of Ibsen. William Empson has argued that what prevented Joyce from being an Irish nationalist was his belief that in Ibsen, Europe was going ahead with its own large development. Now, there's much to be said for that view, and a good deal of biographical evidence in its favour, starting with Joyce's learning enough Norwegian as a young man to read Ibsen in the original, and publishing a high-flying article in the Fortnightly Review to praise Ibsen, and, I think, to tell the world where his own artistic eyes were turning. But in any case, Joyce gave definitive form, starting with the last pages of the portrait, to the desire which begins in Ireland and defines itself in Europe, seeking not its fortune but its providential form. In his domestic life he spoke more Italian than French, more French than English. Finnegan's Wake is Irish of necessity, European in its diction and Egyptian in its major mythology. That should be enough to be going on with if an art of European scale is in question. As an Irishman by necessity, Joyce set astir a fiction, as in Flann O'Brien's At Swim Two Birds and The Third Policeman, a fiction of comic ingenuity, the words on the page in blatant disproportion to any use they might be turned to. As a European on principle, he set a pattern for the disinterested occupation of space. Its chief exponent since Joyce has been Samuel Beckett, a writer as different from Joyce as he could reasonably be, given so many similarities. But as soon as you start naming names to denote such consequences and consanguinities, there's no end to it. Meanwhile, we proceed. Finnegan's Wake is clearly the next item, after 44 years in which most of us have left it pretty well alone. Is it an example of language secreting itself from resources as promiscuous as Europe itself? Or beneath every surface, is it a story not much different from any other? The most recent suggestion I've seen is Hugh Kenner's, that the book started out from some sense of Erskine Childers's execution in 1922 and became a story about a family in Chapel Izzard, ending in the dormant mind of the mother, widowed now, the morning after, trying not to awaken to awareness that her husband lies beside her no longer. We could do worse than begin with that end.
That was Professor Dennis Donoghue talking about James Joyce in our Thomas Davis Lecture Series on an Irish literary landscape. Next week, at the same time, you can hear Professor Terence Brown of the English Department in Trinity College Dublin talking about the autobiographies in the Irish literary tradition. The producer was Michael Littleton. A reminder now that RTE Radio 1 is now accepting entries for the annual short story competition. There are prizes totalling €6,000 and a chance to hear all of the shortlisted stories on air. For full details and an entry form, click on our website at rte.ie or send a stamped addressed envelope to RTE Radio 1, Short Story Competition, RTE Radio Centre, Dublin 4.